Welcome to Real Money Radio, the show that focuses on real people, real problems, and real solutions. Here's your host, certified financial planner, David Holland.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Lots of stuff going on in the news and in the investment world, and so we are bringing another big gun in. Senior columnist, Investment News, Jeff Benjamin. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, how you doing? Thank you for having me again.
It is my pleasure. Jeff is senior columnist for Investment News. 25 years experience. Good grief, man. You are just stacked up with experience, and you've been watching the markets, the economy, and all of this for many years. I applaud your work. I follow Jeff in his writing in Investment News, and Investment News is one of the most respected publications in the country, and advisors like me go to it for timely and relevant, helpful information. So I like to read Jeff's columns and articles, so we want to get him back on the program, and we want to get his take on some recent things happening. I've got a couple things I want to get to, Jeff, if we could, but I have to ask, because I'm sure you're hearing this a lot. We continue to hear what seems to be a kind of a, at least from my perspective, a bit anticlimactic into the whole Bill Gross exit from PIMCO. A lot of noise when he left and surprise. And now that he's over at Janus, it's to me, at least, it seems like it's a little anticlimactic. What do you think?
Well, it certainly was a jarring moment to see that happen. I actually got the email in the form of a press release a couple of Fridays ago around 8:30 in the morning. And I actually responded to the sender of that email. It was from Janus, to ask me if it was a joke, if it was serious. It was,
okay,
you know, that surprising. And then, you know, from there, the wheels started moving, and we spent about a week and a half writing about
it, as
did most of the financial press. In terms of anticlimactic, you know, it's basically quieted down
now. Yeah, that's what I'm really trying to say.
Right. Yeah, Bill Gross did have a big... his first conference call as a member of the Janus team, and I think we're probably going to see a little bit more of that. It's still, at least in my mind, a little bit of a question as to why he would even be making that move at this point in his career, at this point in his life. You know, why not just take your billions and enjoy the beach?
Well, nobody, I guess we won't know unless we can get inside his head. Maybe, and I know that was a rhetorical question, I'll answer anyway, that maybe he didn't want to leave to go to nothing and or to retire, that maybe it was like, I'll leave to go to another firm, and maybe it was a bit of a, I don't know, a message back to the folks at Allianz. But anyway, I was just curious kind of what you thought. Let's get to some other things. I know that there's some recent things that you've been following and tracking that Jeff's been writing about in Investment News, and one of them is Goldman Sachs. I caught your article there talking about Goldman Sachs strategists saying that the investors are holding too much in stocks and bonds, and they need to jack up their allocation to other investment alternatives. So I'd love to talk with you a little bit about that. First, for our listeners, what's an alternative investment, Jeff?
Well, an alternative from the parlance of Wall Street, or from a firm like Goldman Sachs, would be essentially things that are less correlated to a straight investment in a stock or a bond or a stock or a bond mutual fund. So it's something that is designed to be, well, it could be something that goes long and short. It could be something that invests in more esoteric type assets. But basically the safest and most general definition of an alternative is something that's, I can't say non-correlated because everything's a little bit correlated, but much less correlated to the broad markets of stocks and bonds.
Okay, so maybe a real estate investment trust?
Yep.
Okay, maybe a long-term capital financing for trains or self-storage or some of these other things that people wouldn't necessarily think of right away.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. All right. So stuff that moves, and I even heard, and I'm sure you have, of a hedge fund that purchased a baseball team as an investment. So, I mean, it could come in a lot of different shapes and sizes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
So the idea then is that with, you know, historically, or the traditional investment approach, the two levers that people or advisors might pull on and adjust is their concentration or allocation of stocks versus bonds. But these alternative investments are getting more play or more focus on because of what's causing this focus shift, I guess. Is it part of it because of where we are with the interest rate cycle and what bonds have done for the last 20 to 30 years?
It's two major things. Right.
Okay.
Now, the stock market has been on about a six-year tear, valuation. We've seen some volatility recently, but volatility has been relatively low, and the market's been moving, the stock market has been moving essentially in one direction. So some people could say, and I think it would be an easy case to make, that the stock market is close to overvalued, if not easily fairly valued. Then you have the bond market, which has been on a bull market run for about 30 years.
Right.
Bond prices, as you know, go up when bond yields go down, and we're at almost historic low yield levels. So if you combine those two things, stocks and bonds both at pretty much high point, you have to assume that there's risk in those two general asset classes. So you want to diversify away from that risk. And that doesn't mean selling everything in those two categories, but you got to, you know, blend some things in that are going to reduce the risk.
And the way you do that is to have things that don't move in lockstep,
right,
with either stocks or bonds.
Exactly. Well, let me give you one example.
Sure.
This came from the Goldman Sachs, the conversation I had with the two people at Goldman Sachs. If you take a portfolio of a very generic portfolio, 70% stocks, 30% bonds, stocks are going to represent 99% of the risk of that portfolio, of the volatility of that portfolio.
Okay.
And the volatility, as you know, represents risk. But if you took a portfolio of 40% stocks, and then I think it's 3% bonds, I'm not sure about the complete breakdown, but you cut your equity portfolio, you leave your bond portfolio where it was at 30%, and you sprinkle in the rest with alternatives, you can reduce that volatility down to 8.8%, from 12% to 8.8%. So, you know, you're going to get about the same return.
Okay. So the lesson here, or the message, I guess, is that people should at least consider and look at some of these alternatives, and putting a toe in the water and doing a couple percent really doesn't do much. That what the folks over at Goldman Sachs were, I think, suggesting that you had written about, Jeff, was maybe you need to go as much as 25% allocated to some of these alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they were suggesting between 19 and 20% to really have an impact.
Okay.
Otherwise, you're just, and some people do get a toe in the water because they're afraid of the strategy, the category, or they're not familiar with the category. And clearly, if you're not familiar, you don't want to be diving into anything. But it's you know, if you're a financial advisor in this market environment, I got to tell you, I think you're not doing your job if you're not focusing on alternatives to some degree.
Well, I'm going to agree with you on that, Jeff. I think that given where things are, and here's a funny thing from my perspective, out on the firing line, if you will, out here working with retail clients, is if part of what an advisor needs to do, and this is for the investor to be thinking about and looking at, is you need to be looking at new ideas, and you need to be evaluating. And I've had people say to me, well, what do you do if the market goes down? What do you do if it's this or that? What if the market goes down? And my job is the same whether the market's going up or going down. It's to be looking for diversification. It's looking at this asset allocation that you're talking about, and consider alternatives, and just don't put all your eggs in one basket, but be willing to look at things a little differently and get that mix of investments that don't all move the same direction. I think that makes a lot of sense and definitely worth consideration. All right, very good. Jeff Benjamin, ladies and gentlemen, senior columnist, Investment News. If you want to go take a look at what Investment News is all about, of course, their website is investmentnews.com. We're going to grab a quick break, and we'll come and talk a little bit more about another important subject, and that's the Federal Reserve. They are calling out consumers for saving too much. We'll be right back.
Here's a newsflash. All financial advisors are not created equal. Some invest in their education by getting advanced degrees and professional certifications. Some don't. Some advisors get multiple licenses and offer a wide range of solutions. Some don't. Some advisors choose to be independent. Some don't. Some advisors disclose how they are paid and the fees they charge. Some don't. Please don't settle for a don't. Let me introduce you to independent advisor David Holland. David is a CPA, a certified financial planner, a personal financial specialist, and a chartered financial consultant. With 23 years financial experience, David offers a wide range of personalized solutions and discloses all fees in writing. Call Holland Financial at 671-PLAN or visit planstronger.com to schedule your one-on-one meeting.
And we're back. It's all about the Benjamins. Jeff Benjamin. I had to get that in there. I'm sorry, Jeff.
No problem.
The unfortunate thing for you and for my listeners is I write all my own material. So anyway, Jeff Benjamin is on the line with us, senior columnist, Investment News, and we're very happy to have Jeff back. Welcome anytime. Another topic in the news is, of course, all eyes on the Fed. And they just released their minutes, all the notes to their conversations about what they will do next. And another recent article that Jeff wrote about was about the Federal Reserve and getting some kind of a sense for where they're moving or may move with interest rates. So I don't want to steal your thunder here, Jeff, but what are you seeing? What do the tea leaves tell us about the Fed's posturing and position? And is there a lot of disagreement in the Fed, or do they really all have kind of a sense for moving in the same direction at the same pace?
Well, the Fed, as you know, has essentially two primary mandates: to manage through monetary policy, manage unemployment and inflation. They have focused a lot on unemployment over the past year or so, largely on unemployment. And recently, it started to look like they maybe took the eye off the ball of inflation. And inflation is actually at risky low levels now.
Yeah, it's very low. In fact, it borders on, what's the latest gauge that you've seen? It can't be more than 1% or so.
Yeah, it's definitely below 2, and
okay.
Their target is 2.5 or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's close to 1. So the concern is that, well, for as far as the outlook goes for interest rates, with inflation now at this risky low level, it kind of pushes out even further the idea of the Fed raising rates anytime soon. We're already at least 6 months from something like that happening.
Oh, yeah. I would definitely say at least that. Yeah, so if I hear you correctly, then even if the shift of the focus from unemployment does happen at some point, they may not necessarily have a need or a desire to then turn around and combat inflation because they're really more concerned about deflation more so than inflation.
Right. The Fed doesn't, the Fed obviously only has so many tools, and their main one is to adjust the overnight rate up or down. Well, they can't go much lower.
Yeah, they're already at a quarter point on the discount rate, right?
So it's and the piece that you referenced at the top of the segment was the Fed was basically saying in order for this whole system to work, there has to be what they call a velocity of money. Money has to start moving around, and they kind of singled out consumers for saving too much money
yeah.
in this environment, and clearly that's not what they want to happen. That's why they moved interest rates so low. They don't want people. There's no reason to sit on money right now. If you're going to do anything with it, invest it or spend it, from their perspective.
I see. In other words, they've structured it so that you're not going to get any real return. So do something, spend it or invest or find some other place for it.
They took every incentive out.
Yeah.
And in terms of the Fed, the mindset, a lot of people have been talking about the Fed being lit and all that other stuff. But I was in San Diego recently and listening to a presentation from somebody from the Potomac Research Group. And he follows the Fed pretty closely. He said that this Fed is virtually in lockstep in terms of being on the same page. And that page is a very dovish perspective. They're very big fans of keeping interest rates low and holding off on raising rates.
Okay, slower to move on rates. Well, one of the things that's interesting to me is a lot of times that people do overlook or maybe not be aware of the different interest rates. You mentioned earlier the federal funds rate, which is right now basically at 0.25%, and that's the overnight rate. That's what for banks to borrow from the Fed and or that banks mm-hmm. might lend to each other, the overnight rate.
Right.
And then that rate is very important because that rate affects what banks will lend at with a prime rate. And typically, it runs about 3% over that federal fund rate. So right now, prime is about 3.25, and that's why it's 0.25+3. And then it is used by the banks to determine what they're going to borrow money at from the CD owner. And that's why those rates are so low. The 0.0001% somebody's earning on their money market account is because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's on one end of the equation. And I think you're right. I don't think there's any real motivation from the Fed standpoint to raise that rate anytime soon because they don't necessarily want to encourage that cash buildup in those money market and savings accounts. But it's happening anyway. And on the other end, they've got their quantitative easing. What are we at about? They've tapered it off to what, about $15 billion a month?
I think that's what it is
okay.
right now.
And it's back at the very beginning. What at the height, it was what, at $85
billion? That was the peak. But keep in mind, even if they cut tapering to zero, if they taper to zero, where they're not buying any
right.
Bonds or mortgages on a monthly basis, they're still going to have a portfolio of over $4 trillion.
Right, right.
So the Fed is in no way out of quantitative easing just because they're tapering down to zero. It's a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
But there's a long way to go before the Fed is letting this market, at least the interest rate market, move freely.
That's an excellent point. Very excellent point, Jeff. Because all expectations are that they will finish the taper. It's just kind of funny to think that they're going to finish the taper, but they're going to taper it off, and it'll be zero bond buying and zero maybe the mortgage backs as well. But they'll be sitting there with that $4 trillion portfolio. And then what to do then? They just sit back and they, as those securities mature, they get the cash and it goes on the Fed's balance sheet?
No, I think they're gonna keep rolling them over into buying more of those same securities.
Okay.
So that's why they're still in the market.
I got you. So that's what continues.
Right. There's no plan to sell off that portfolio yet.
Okay.
That's why people need to realize that, you know, that when, what was it, a year ago when there was what they called the taper scare?
Yeah.
The Fed talked about tapering. And
yeah, the 10-year treasuries jumped up to almost 3%.
Freaked out a little bit. But it's such a long process. And that's good because it's a lot of money we're talking about.
Well, and we don't want a shock to the system if they're doing anything radical or fast.
Exactly. But the thing is people think, oh, tapering, or we're going to, you know, finish quantitative easing, the buying process of these bonds. That's still a long, long way from being out of the quantitative easing business. As long as the Fed's sitting on that money and rolling it over when these things mature, we're still very much, we're into quantitative easing in a big way and probably for a long time.
Well, it is very interesting and the effects are profound and I don't think they can be really under, I think people, you know, you can't overestimate the impact here. Jeff Benjamin's our guest today, ladies and gentlemen, senior columnist, Investment News, investmentnews.com. We'll grab a break. We'll come back and talk a little bit about expectations for raising rates. Stay right there.
Does getting financial advice seem like a game of cat and mouse? Then maybe it's time to hire a fiduciary. What's a fiduciary? That's a financial professional who puts the needs of his clients ahead of his own. Being a fiduciary also means that the advisor should recommend the products and services he believes will best serve his clients' needs, not what an insurance or investment company tells him he has to sell. So next time you're talking to an advisor, ask him, "Are you a fiduciary?" The answer should only be yes or no. If the advisor doesn't know, then the answer is probably no. This public service announcement has been brought to you by Holland Financial. We want to help you to plan stronger. For more information, call 671-PLAN or visit planstronger.com. Do you have financial questions you'd like answered on this show? Send them to questions@planstronger.com. You will remain anonymous.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We are with Jeff Benjamin. And Jeff, I wanted to speak a little further to interest rates and expectations. And I thought it's really, I appreciate your insight on this $4 trillion portfolio that the Federal Reserve is going to hold in essentially treasury notes and other treasury debt instruments, basically the money that we are lending ourselves or that the government needs to run in excess of what they collect in tax revenues. And also mortgage-backed securities. So the quantitative easing, while they aren't buying anymore, they're going to keep, as stuff matures, they will take those dollars and buy more. So basically, they're just holding firm or keeping kind of a locked position on the amount of cash that they have put into. That means that they're keeping that $4 trillion in the financial system that wouldn't be in the system if they redeemed those and went ahead and let those various securities mature.
Right, they're keeping their portfolio basically
right.
intact,
because if
opposed to letting it go to cash.
Right, if they let it go to cash, then in effect they would be soaking up cash out of the system.
Right, and
okay,
right,
okay.
So they're keeping the system essentially in balance with what it is right now in terms
yeah.
of the bonds outstanding and the appetite for bonds. Remember, a $4 trillion portfolio I mean, kind of hard to get your head around how big that actually is, but if you take that out of the system, that would have a shock to the system right there.
Yeah, and I don't know if we could come up with an estimate here, but if you, let's just say that the average maturity is, I'll be generous and say the average maturity is 10 years, okay? So does that mean that $400 billion of securities could be mature, at some point will start maturing every year, and then need to be, that cash needs to be, would then be purchasing newly issued treasury or mortgage-backed securities. Yeah, so there's the magnitude of, depending on how long some of these investments are, I mean, that's a lot of continued soaking up and encouraging that, soaking up those securities and keeping the cash in the system. And in fact, they're keeping the cruise control on 75 miles an hour going down the interstate.
Right.
Yeah, they're maintaining a very liberal or lax, if somebody wants to use that word, a very open spigot monetary policy.
Right.
Yeah.
And they don't really have a choice. If you look at what's happening in the markets right now, as we said, we were talking about inflation, and inflation is something that we need in this economy, and the Fed hasn't figured out a way to get it yet. So until we see something more than what we're seeing right now in terms of unemployment and inflation, we should expect the Fed to hold a big portfolio for a long time.
It's very interesting, and we talked about the impact that the short-term rates, that federal funds rate, that 0.25%, how it's used for prime and how it's used for CD rates, and generally prime's 3 over that 0.25%, which is why it's at 3.25% right now, and CDs maybe 1 or 2%, typically 2% less than the prime, and that's where the bank makes their money, is on that 2% spread. At the other end of the spectrum, all of the stuff that they have purchased, Jeff, these mortgage backs and the treasury securities, that has had a depressing effect on the yield we see for 10-year treasuries, which the time we're doing this program is between 2.3 and 2.5% for a 10-year treasury. That's used for sets the standard for what corporate bonds, municipal bonds, all of them are derived mm-hmm. as some sort of interest rate above that 10-year treasury. And also it is used to derive what mortgage rates for homes are. And so if they hold where they are, that could mean continuation, at least for a period of time, of these lower interest rates on 15 and 30-year mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that part is good because they're trying to encourage the economic activity, and it still can bode well for the homeowner and the home buyer.
Right, and that's, again, the effort that the Fed is making to, you know, you can imagine what would happen if, you know, in an economy that is limping along at best, despite what the stock market's doing, and you start to raise those rates, and suddenly people that are thinking about buying a house or thinking about refinancing or buying a car, all those things just get a lot more expensive. And there you have an economy that's maybe not that strong anyway, and even though it is the strongest economy in the world right now of the developed nations, and it could be bad. So the Fed is in a tight spot, and that's why everybody I talk to, they you know, can't put a gun to anybody's head and make them tell you when rates are going to go up, because everybody's just kind of guessing. But
right.
You know, we're looking at, you know, 6 months from now at best.
Yeah. I actually, my own personal opinion, Jeff, and it, you know, it's just my perspective is, you know, they're not raising that federal fund rate for a while, and I just don't see them doing that. And I think they're going to let, after they do finish this final $15 billion a month purchases, they're going to let that then absorb, and maybe hopefully they'll see a little creep up on inflation. But I think that the risks are so much greater, as you described, of jacking rates up or doing something that then all of a sudden clamps down and people go back into a bunker mentality and ain't no way I'm buying a house. I mean, you know, it's not like, no pun intended, that the doors are being beaten down on home purchases. A lot of the mortgage activity, as you know, has been refinancing, taking advantage of these lower rates. So I think that would be catastrophic to raise them quickly. We'll have to see how it plays out. And the other component here, which we got a couple of minutes here, I'd love for you to speak to what you're seeing or hearing on the tax side of this. One of the current topics that's been talked a lot about is these corporate tax inversions. And will we see, where are you hearing that taxes are going to fit into this whole equation?
Well, my thinking is, if we're getting a little bit into politics now, but, you know, that's, I'm probably no less of an expert on politics than I am on anything else.
Are we all?
I'm just an observer.
Yeah.
But the talk is that if anything could happen in the next 2 years, corporate taxes could be dealt with. Individual tax rates are, there's too many things in the pot there.
Yeah.
You've got all these different exemptions, and everybody's yeah. got something that is going to have a lobby behind it. But corporate taxes, I mean, you know, look at the recent deal Burger King trying to buy that Tim Hortons donut and coffee chain, a Canadian-based company. When Canada becomes a tax haven for the U.S., that should be a signal to anybody in Washington that our taxes are, our corporate level taxes are out of line. And when you start losing companies to Canada, which has never been known as a tax haven, you know, then you've got issues. So that is likely to be addressed. I mean, you can certainly pass laws to say companies can't do this, but
yeah.
you know, in a free market, in a capitalist society, laws are meant to be worked around. And if you tell Burger King that they can't
you can't have it. You can't have it your way at Burger King.
Yeah. Well, what's Burger King going to do? They're going to say, "Well, why? We're a Canadian company now.
Right.
I don't think you have any laws over us. You can I guess tax our franchises or something." But there you go. It's I think there's hope for corporate taxes, and that could curtail some of these inversions.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to wait and see what plays out, and I hope you'll come back and give us another update, Jeff. Jeff Benjamin, ladies and gentlemen, senior columnist, Investment News, investmentnews.com. And thank you very much, Jeff. I appreciate your insight.
Thank you.
Today's edition of Real Money Radio has been brought to you by Holland Financial, conveniently located on Granada Boulevard in Ormond Beach. Could you benefit from a one-on-one confidential conversation with David Holland, or would you like a second opinion to make sure that you're on the right track? Call Holland Financial at 671-PLAN or visit us at planstronger.com to schedule your no-obligation consultation. David looks forward to discussing the financial issues that matter most to you. The host of Real Money Radio, David Holland, is a certified financial planner with over 20 years of experience. And because David provides advice to clients on a daily basis, his hyperactive compliance department wants us to tell you that David Holland is an investment advisor representative of Holland Advisory Services, a registered investment advisory firm. He offers insurance and annuity products through Holland Insurance Services. Commentary given during this radio program should not be considered investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed concerning specific securities are not an offer to buy or sell. Investment advice and planning services can only be given after an analysis of an individual situation and only where Holland Advisory Services is registered or exempt from registering. Real Money Radio is produced by Holland Productions.